with. So with that, I think we'll introduce Mr. Jim Nobles, a legislative auditor, and welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is John Yunker. Also in the audience is Carrie Meyerhoff, who is also a member of this evaluation team. For some of you in the audience who may not be familiar with the Office of the Legislative Auditor, we are an audit and evaluation office for the Minnesota Legislature. And each year, the Legislative Audit Commission approves 6 or 8 evaluations for us to conduct. The one we're discussing today was approved last year. It was recommended by a number of legislators and then approved by the Legislative Audit Commission for us. The results of the evaluation are the responsibility of the Office of the Legislative Auditor and purely represent our findings and conclusions and recommendations. When this topic was being suggested, I think some people wondered why we would be evaluating prevailing wages. It is, after all, a highly controversial and fairly political issue, an issue that is left mostly to policymakers. We did look in this evaluation at some of the arguments against and for prevailing wages, and my prediction will be that we will not fully settle all of those policy questions and issues today. But what we can give you is a detailed examination of how the law is implemented and enforced. We found some things that are going well, and we found some things that need improvement. To tell you more about what we found and what we recommend, I want to call on Mr. Yunker to make a brief presentation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Knowles. Mr. Yunker, welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Yunker, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm going to give you a little bit of background about the prevailing wage law and then talk about our conclusions and recommendations in our report. Minnesota is one of 32 states who, along with the federal government, have prevailing wage laws. Minnesota's prevailing wage law sets a floor on the wages and benefits that can be paid to construction workers on state-funded projects. That means contractors and subcontractors working on those projects must pay at least the prevailing wage rate that's set by the Department of Labor and Industry. State-funded projects mean projects that are undertaken by state agencies, but it can also include local government projects if they receive some direct state funding, and they do include some private development projects such as Job Z projects. The law covers projects of $25,000 or more, and this has been the law since 1973. That number hasn't changed. It can go as low as $2,500 if only one job class is involved. As I mentioned, labor and industry sets these rates. They're set for 147 job classes. They're set for commercial construction by county. They're set for highway heavy construction in each of 10 regions. And overall, labor and industry can set more than 4,600 prevailing wage rates. So it gets to be a little complex and complicated in terms of how many different rates are being set. They set these rates based on information received from an annual wage and benefits survey of the construction industry, where they focus specifically on commercial construction, office building construction, and other building construction, and on highway heavy construction. The survey does not ask for information about residential construction because prevailing wage rates are not set for that, and wage rates and fringe benefits for residential construction are much different than those for commercial and highway heavy construction. State law says that labor and industry must use the most frequently reported rate for a job class and geographic area to set the prevailing wage rate. What that's often called, or at least statisticians call it, the mode. That's not the median, it's not the average, but it's the mode, the most frequently reported wage and benefit rate. And I should also say here that I'm often going to, people will always call this the prevailing wage rates, but they include both wages and benefits. There are a number of issues that have been talked about over the years with respect to the prevailing wage law, and they get to be quite controversial. I'll kind of sum them up rather quickly. Critics and supporters disagree about what the fiscal and economic impact of prevailing wage rates are. Critics say that prevailing wage laws increase public construction costs because wages and benefits tend to be higher when you have a prevailing wage law. They argue that construction costs must be higher, and so the public is paying a price. Supporters say, though, that if you pay a higher wage and benefit to workers, you get higher skilled workers, more productive workers. They produce more, get more done in a given amount of time. And as a result, even though you pay them more, you don't necessarily increase construction costs. Supporters also argue that the quality of construction, when you use more highly skilled workers, is better. There's been disagreement about what methods that labor and industry have used to survey contractors and unions about wages and benefits. In particular, critics have said that the survey does not produce results that are representative of construction industry wages and benefits, and have suggested using a different survey. Obviously, there's been disagreement about the method for calculating prevailing wage rates. Critics have said that using the mode is unfair, and they'd prefer to have the average or the median rate be used instead. And finally, there's been discussion about enforcement because there's a belief on the part of some that enforcement in Minnesota is not adequate. What did we find? First of all, as Mr. Nobles alluded to, we don't think there are any clear answers about what the fiscal and economic impact of prevailing wage laws are, and I'll discuss that a little bit in a moment. So we don't know for sure how prevailing wage laws affect construction costs or construction quality. Second, we do think that the Department of Labor and Industry survey raises some concerns and needs some improvement, but we think it's the best alternative out there, and we don't support using a different survey. In particular, we think that that there needs to be work done to improve the response rate to the current survey. We also conclude that some prevailing wage rates are not representative of reported wages from the survey. And this is largely because Minnesota uses the mode to set the prevailing wage rate. And as we'll see, some other states use the mode, but they only use it under certain circumstances. I would point out, though, however, that the problem I'm referring to here, I think, is more the exception than the rule. So we have some unrepresentative rates, but they're more the exception than the rule. We also, in the process of looking at prevailing wage rates, looked at how labor and industry sets the rates, and what we found was that they weren't always following some of the detailed technical rules about how to calculate the rates, and they were making some errors, too, in calculation of rates when it involved the human element of setting the rates. And I'll talk a little bit more about those. It does affect potentially hundreds of rates, so I think it's a significant issue. But these largely involve kind of technical issues. And finally, we found that with the exception of state-funded highway projects, we think there is inadequate enforcement of the prevailing wage law. On the issue of fiscal and economic impacts of prevailing wage laws, there are studies that find that prevailing wage laws increase construction costs. We take issue with some of those studies for the assumptions they use. But there are also studies that find that prevailing wage laws have no statistically significant impact on construction costs. And while we have some concerns about their methods as well, I think the evidence is mixed, and it's not possible for us to reach a firm conclusion on how prevailing wage laws affect construction costs. There's also little or no evidence on construction quality. There are no studies out there that address this issue, and so we can't take a position on how prevailing wage laws affect construction quality. As I mentioned, we conclude that labor and industry survey, while it has there are some legitimate concerns about it, there really is no better alternative. It's been suggested by some critics that instead of the Labor and Industry Survey, we ought to use the Occupational Employment Statistics Survey that's done by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. But we find a number of flaws with that particular survey. One, that it includes residential construction wage rates. Two, that it doesn't include fringe benefits. Three, that it has a limited time frame. And four, it has restrictive survey procedures that are determined by the federal government and not particularly suitable for setting prevailing wage rates. However, as I said, Labor and Industry Survey has some shortcomings as well. And in particular, we think there needs to be work to try to improve the response rate to the survey. In 2005, there were not enough responses to set prevailing wage rates, two-thirds of the commercial prevailing wage rates, if you try to set them based on responses from a particular county. The county you're trying to set them for, two-thirds of the time, they didn't have enough responses to set prevailing wage rates. They had to go to adjacent county data or to prior year rates. And half of the time with highway heavy rates, even though you've got a very large region from which you're setting the rates, there wasn't enough data to set prevailing wage rates. So there's some real concerns about the survey that labor and industry does, but I think there are ways to try to improve that. Let's talk a little bit about the calculation method that Minnesota uses. Just a little reminder here, Minnesota, as I said before, uses the mode to set prevailing wage rates. That's clarified to some extent by a state rule, which says if there's more than one mode, and we'll see an example right away of that, you use the highest mode. So in this particular case, in northwestern Minnesota, for a group of power equipment operators, there were 13 wage and benefit rates that were reported, and most of those rates were reported for only one worker. Two of them were reported for four workers each, $13.86 and $15.52. The prevailing wage rate was set based on the $15.52 because that's the highest of the two modes. I want to talk a little bit about the criticisms of Minnesota's use of the mode. It's been suggested that it's only used by one other state besides Minnesota, that it discourages non-union firms from responding to the survey. And in particular, what the non-union sector says is that union workers tend to be paid for a particular job class in a particular geographic area. They tend to be paid the same wage and benefit rate. And so they're all coming in at the same rate, and non-union workers are paid based on what they call the merit system, so they're being paid a different wage rate for each employee. So the non-union firms claim that they can never be the mode because they're never going to have more than one worker. It'd be not so likely that they'd have more than one worker at any one given wage and benefit rate. Furthermore, critics say that the prevailing wage, the use of the mode frequently results in setting prevailing wage rates at union rates, and that it sets higher rates than are generally paid in a given geographic area. So I want to look at each one of these criticisms and tell you what we can say about them and what we conclude as a result. There are actually 20 states that use the mode, but most of those states do it a little differently than Minnesota. There are 5 states, including Minnesota, that use the mode like we do. There are 15 states that use the mode, but they only use it if it represents a minimum percentage of reported wages. So, for example, New Mexico and Wyoming will use the mode, but only if it represents 30% or more of the reported wages. Maryland and Nevada, only if it represents 40%. And most of these states will only use the mode if it represents a majority of the reported wages. The federal government is in that latter category. What you can see here, too, is there are only 2 states that go right to the average rate. I should mention that the 15 states that use the mode, if they don't use the mode because it doesn't represent that minimum percentage, they generally go to an average rate. They compute the average reported rate. There are also, as you can see here, 6 states that don't do a survey. They immediately go to the collectively bargained rates. So it's a more complex picture than has been portrayed typically. I said that the non-union firms complained that they're discouraged from responding to the survey. That's kind of difficult to verify, but one of the problems is that there just aren't enough responses to the survey. And there are actually plenty of opportunities for anyone to have an influence on the survey by responding to it. In 2005, out of 4,600 some rates, there were 3,000 rates that could have been set in a county or a region with only one or two workers' rates being reported. Because there wasn't one or two, they had to go to an adjacent county or to a prior year rate. So there are lots of opportunities to influence the rate, but you need to respond to the survey. As I said, it's been alleged that there are too many union rates. Well, that's a really tough argument for us to analyze. It is true that more than half of the 2005 prevailing wage rates were union rates, but union labor's share of commercial and highway heavy work is unknown. We don't know how much of the work that's done in the construction industry in the private sector is done by union labor for commercial and highway heavy work. Do prevailing wages reflect market rates? Are they representative of what's reported on the survey? Or does the mode kind of get in the way of that? That's difficult for us to analyze because you'd like to have some data out there that told you what's being paid in the construction industry. And the only thing we have to go by is what's reported in the labor and industry survey. So if you go by that, what you see is that most prevailing wage rates are based on a majority of reported wages. In fact, two-thirds of the prevailing wage rates are based on a majority of reported wages. This is an example of that. Carpenters in Hubbard County. There were 42 workers' wages and benefit rates reported in the 2005 survey. 24 were at one rate. 6 were higher than that. So I'll just do the math. 57% were at $28.15, and that was the mode, and that's what was used to set the prevailing wage rate. And 14% were at a rate even higher than that. So 71% of all the reported rates were at the mode or higher. The mode did represent at least a majority of what was being reported on the survey. But there are examples that go in the other direction. As I said, it's more the exception than the rule, but some prevailing wage rates appear to be unrepresentative of reported wages. And here's an example of that. Common laborers in Monoman County, there were 15 workers' wages reported. There are actually 5 modes here where 2 workers were reported at the same wage and benefit rate. But the highest mode is used according to department rules. So the prevailing wage rate was based on the highest mode, which was $24.24. That's for 2 workers out of 15, or about 13% of the reported wage and benefit rates. The other 87% were at wages between benefits between $10 and $13.50, well below what the prevailing wage rate was set at. So in this case, I think you could argue that the prevailing wage rate is not really representative of the wages that are paid out there in the community. As I mentioned earlier, we did find some problems with how the department set prevailing wage rates. We found some problems with their computer program. The first one that's mentioned here actually affects more than 300 prevailing wage rates, so it's potentially rather significant. And there are recommendations in the report for the department to address those concerns. And here are some of those recommendations. And beyond that, I guess I would say also that this first recommendation is rather significant. We think steps should be taken to try to improve the survey response rate. I think that's going to take some outreach. It's going to take some work on the part of the department to tell people why it is they need to respond to the survey, what's in it for them. There is money in the governor's budget proposal to accomplish that. Beyond that, most of these recommendations pertain to the mistakes that I think the department has been making in setting rates. I want to talk just a little bit about the prevailing hours of labor, which I haven't mentioned so far. State law says, and it has said this from since 1973, that the prevailing hours of labor are 8 hours a day and 40 hours a week. Well, that doesn't mean this is how long a construction worker can work on a prevailing wage project. These are simply the hours that are used to determine when do you start paying overtime. Any hours worked in excess of those limits require, according to state law, overtime pay at 1.5 times the wage component of the prevailing wage rate. This has been the law for many years, but I think the construction industry has changed. And in particular, some union contracts have four 10-hour days, so 40 hours a week. So they're much more flexible on the number of daily hours before overtime pay is required. What we suggest in the report is that the legislature consider being more flexible on this requirement so that on prevailing wage projects, we're not paying overtime in those cases where even the unions don't require overtime to be paid. I want to talk about enforcement because, as I said before, other than state highway projects, we really think that enforcement is inadequate. According to state law, MnDOT is responsible for enforcement of the prevailing wage law on state-funded highway projects. Labor and industry, according to the law, has a responsibility for all other projects. And when you think about all other projects, that includes projects that are done by the Department of Administration, by MNSCU, the University of Minnesota, the zoo, DNR, local governments who happen to get direct state funding for a project, and even Job Z projects. So that's an awful lot of ground to cover. And besides, labor and industry, unlike MnDOT, doesn't have control over those construction contracts. MnDOT does a fairly good job. I haven't heard many complaints about the enforcement that they're doing of the prevailing wage law. They require contractors to submit certified payroll records, and they review them. Certified payroll records tell MnDOT on each construction project who's working on it, what job class they're working in, what they're getting paid. MnDOT can review those to see if that's consistent with the prevailing wage requirements, and then they do site interviews, and they interview workers to see whether or not they're being paid according to what's in those certified payroll records and whether they're being properly put in the right job class. As I mentioned, MnDOT is able to withhold contract payments, so they can do that to enforce the prevailing wage law. And they've worked on developing contract language for their construction contracts that supports their enforcement efforts and lays out exactly when they're going to withhold the contract payments, when they can terminate a contract, when they can debar a contractor for not violating from future work for violating the prevailing wage law. And finally, MnDOT has allocated resources not only in their regional offices for kind of monitoring day-to-day projects, but also for investigating in their central office the more complex cases that arise. On all other projects where labor and industry has the responsibility, there's confusion about who's responsible. Law says labor and industry is responsible, so the contracting agencies, the MNSCU's, Department of Administration, University of Minnesota, think labor and industry enforces the law. But labor and industry has said for a long time that they have no resources for enforcement, and they don't have effective enforcement authority. They can't withhold payment from a contractor because they don't control the construction contract. And it's extremely difficult to get a prosecution of a prevailing wage violation in this state. They're misdemeanor violations, and local prosecutors generally will not pursue them. So having labor and industry being the only agency responsible for enforcement just doesn't work, and it hasn't worked for years. What we suggest is that the legislature give contracting agencies the authority and the responsibility to monitor and enforce compliance. They're the only ones who are in the right position to do that. But I think when you do that, you also have to direct labor and industry to provide training and technical assistance to those contracting agencies and have labor and industry have a investigative capability to help out the agencies on more complex cases. We also suggest in the report that the legislature require contractors on prevailing wage jobs to submit certified payroll records. There's two reasons for doing that. One is kind of what MnDOT does. They use them to monitor compliance with the prevailing wage law. The second reason is if a contractor lies, falsifies the record, lies in that certified payroll record, that violation of the prevailing wage law can be converted from a misdemeanor offense to a felony offense. So there's more grounds there for prosecuting and perhaps getting a settlement with the contractor. We also think that you might want to think about enhanced penalties, perhaps a role for the Attorney General. That role would be to prosecute cases if the Attorney General so chose, when a local prosecutor declines to prosecute. And another enforcement tool to think about is a private right to sue for workers who are involved. Finally, you need to think about additional funding, both for the labor and industry, but also how to get contracting agencies to get involved. And there, I think, one mechanism to possibly use would be for contracting agencies to use their capital budget funds. They typically have an architect or an owner's rep or someone who's monitoring the construction project, and one of their duties could be to monitor compliance with the prevailing wage law. Finally, we also have some recommendations for labor and industry, but I'm not going to go into them in detail. They're the kinds of things we think they ought to be doing in their enforcement role. Mr. Chairman, that concludes our presentation, and we'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
You guys, John, do you suggest any language on the legislative recommendations, or you just tell us what you think and then we draft some legislation? Is that clear? I mean, you're telling us kind of what to do, but you don't have the – or what you recommend, but is it up to us to create some language to handle these recommendations?
Mr. Chairman, members, traditionally the Office of the Legislative Auditor has not drafted legislation.
Okay, that's what I
thought. We work with legislators. But we do not lobby for implementation of our recommendations.
Okay, I guess I'm aware of that. Okay, that's fine. Any questions of the folks from the auditor's office at this point? Senator Gerlach?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to bring a reference to, and maybe you could go in a little more detail on the fiscal and economic impacts. It sounds like you went after that and came up with really nothing. At the, on the one side, as the controversy goes, some would say it artificially drives up costs. On the other side, some would say that it guarantees good quality in construction and you know what you're getting. But you find unclear impact on construction costs and little direct evidence on the construction quality. So why, if that's the fact, we're not paying any more, but we're not getting more for it, why do we even do this? I guess is my question.
Mr. Yunker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gerlach. Well, I think that's a question for the legislature, first of all. It's not a question for us. It's a policy question. Although I think it could be argued that if it doesn't have any harm, if it doesn't have any benefit, what's the concern about it either? I mean, you don't necessarily need to get rid of something if there's no harm involved either. There's no cost involved. There's a whole chapter devoted to this whole issue, and it's there for you to take a look at. I think part of the reason why we can't resolve this is that a lot of the studies have been done that have looked at this have been done by or been funded by either the supporters of prevailing wage laws or the critics. There's been a vested interest in what the results have been, and there are some academic studies, so there are some things for us to take a look at. And we looked at all the studies, just to be fair. Overall, we think it's a wash, that we cannot really come to a firm conclusion. That doesn't mean that prevailing wage laws don't have an impact on construction quality. That doesn't mean that prevailing wage laws don't have some impact on construction costs. We just can't tell you for sure what it is.
Did I hear you say that the governor put some money in his budget for additional enforcement?
Mr. Chairman, no, not for additional enforcement of the prevailing wage law. My understanding that the money in the governor's budget is for trying to improve the response rate to the survey that they conduct every year, trying to get contractors more involved in responding to the survey. But there is no money that I'm aware of in the governor's budget for additional enforcement that would respond to the recommendations in this report.
Senator Murphy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, kind of to answer the question that was posed, I think it keeps us from having low-paid employees with a low skill set and thus poor craft work. At least we can keep our journey men and women out there involved in the construction process earning a decent wage, and that turns around. I would say that that the prevailing wage law has been a benefit to the state of Minnesota, especially greater Minnesota, because every one of those dollars that's spent on somebody's paycheck, it's turned around on Main Street 7 times. That's a good thing whether you're in Apple Valley or Red Wing.
I thought it was $6.50, but it's $7.
Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm just kidding. Those are. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, am looking at the economic impact here. And I'm reading that it says it results in an improvement in wages of construction workers, a significant increase in their fringe benefits, which I think are very good. But my question is about the training. It says that research suggests that prevailing wage laws have a positive impact on training levels. But then you go on to say that it doesn't necessarily affect the quality. But if you have better trained workers, doesn't that follow that, you know, they would be probably doing a higher quality of work?
Mr. Yucker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, you know, I suppose that argument could be made. I think what we're simply saying is there is no direct evidence on construction quality. Nobody has looked at construction quality and tried to do a study. The studies also on training come up with some widely different estimates of how much prevailing wage laws affect training. So there's some uncertainty there about exactly how much prevailing wage laws affect the amount of training and skills that are involved in construction work.
Senator Gimsey.
I guess being in construction, I can probably comment a little bit about the quality of work done under prevailing wage. Contractors in my area of the state also bid on prevailing wage projects, and their employees receive a tremendous amount more money for doing state-funded projects and things like that when prevailing wage is required. I also would like to ask, I have some jurisdictions that are saying that under Job Z's program, that when an analysis is done by people who are willing to come into a Job Z zone to build and move jobs into these Job Z zones, that when they do their analysis, they're finding that it's more expensive using prevailing wage and the other restrictions under the Job Z zone than it is to go someplace else and create those jobs. Have you heard anything about that? Do you have any input as far as that is?
Mr. Yucker.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gimsey, we did not look at that specifically. We've heard some of those concerns. You know, again, I think the way to address this is to work to try to improve the survey response rate and to get more contractors reporting. There have been some cases where the contractors have gotten involved and reported more of their wage information, and that's had an impact on the prevailing wage rate.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just elaborate, I think Mr. Yonker makes the point well, but I think it just really deserves some emphasis that, you know, the Department of Labor and Industry isn't looking at a book somewhere to figure out what the prevailing wage is going to be. They're getting data from out in communities, reported from a variety of sources, and that's the basis for their determination of what the prevailing wage is going to be. So it is an attempt in state law and in the way it's implemented to reflect what is the prevailing wage in a community, whether it's a Job Z zone or not. But that will only be carried out in practice if we have extensive good data that in fact represents the wages that are being paid there. And as we point out in the evaluation, there's some real limitations and deficiencies in the survey data that is obtained. And it can result in some skewing, and I think we point that out. So we go back to a need to improve the data. That is the basis. That's the foundation for whether we are, in setting prevailing wages, reflecting the competitive marketplace in your community and other communities.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, it seems to me that what would happen out there is that employers on the high end of the scale who are typically paying those higher wages have a higher motivation to report those wages than does a company that pays the lower amount. They don't, you know, they don't have that motivation. You know, private companies just typically don't probably submit that type of information. They don't have the for lack of a better term, the motivation to hand out their payroll records to give you that information. So it would seem to me that because of that, that the numbers would be skewed.
Well, Mr. Chairman, again, whether they had the motivation or not, I think that's going to be the key to getting better data, and you're going to probably hear from the department, and you've heard reference to the fact that the governor has included in his budget recommendations to you money to improve the survey results. So I think in our evaluation and the governor's recommendation and undoubtedly what you're going to hear from the department, that is the key, getting better data and maybe stimulating some greater motivation out there to report the full range of wage data that's being paid.
Senator Tomasoni?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it just seems to me that it's 2 + 2 = 4 here, and that the reason we have the prevailing wage law is to make sure that people who are doing these jobs are actually being paid and being paid well enough to support a family and take care of the expenses and all the rest of the stuff that goes along with working. And if people who are on the lower end don't want to report, that's part of their problem. I don't think it's got anything to do with the prevailing wage thing. But these laws are good laws from the standpoint that they want to make sure that people doing these construction jobs aren't being underpaid. And I think the report is a pretty good report. What I'm wondering is, maybe this is a question for the department, but is there an indication that the department doesn't have enough people to actually enforce the laws, or that there's no way to enforce the law, or do you have any evidence of that? I'm just wondering, does the department understand that they're responsible for everything other than the highway projects?
We're going to hear from them in a minute. I would guess they do know that. Mr. Yonker, is that correct? I mean, they know what. They either don't have the personnel or it's not getting done, so we're going to figure out how to get it done, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I think they would say that they neither have the resources nor the effective enforcement authority, because they cannot withhold payment from construction contracts. Trying to pursue misdemeanor violations is futile.
Got some language.
And they're not in a good position to enforce the law anyway, because they're not out there. They're not in a position to monitor what's going on an ongoing basis with a construction project. MnDOT, on the other hand, is out there in the field with their own projects. That's kind of the right model, we think. The agency that's administering the construction contract is the one that can see what's going on and talk to the workers on occasion and ask them what they're getting paid.
Mr. Chair, maybe that's the better question. How do we get to the point where just MnDOT is the only agency that does their own monitoring? Has that just been state law for forever?
You wonder sometimes, I don't know the cost here, but for example, Minsky, they let a building and it's a $18.5 million building, for example, and 10-12% are architects and engineers and kind of fluffy money. I know it's real money, but I mean, what part of this where Minsky can do their own, it wouldn't be substantial, would it? So you got an $18 million building, right? You got $2.5 million set aside for this and that and some other stuff. What does it cost for Minsky, the example, to turn in these reports? And it's not $500,000 on a $16 million project. I don't know what it is, but I wouldn't think it's a big number. They should be told that they have to, with the contract they let, to report this stuff.
Okay, but should we hear from...
Maybe there's a reason for this. Because maybe the state law say that Dolly's in charge of everything other than highway and heavy, and that's the reason Minsky doesn't do it. I mean, would we have to require Minsky to do it as a result?
I think that's some of the findings that we have to figure it out as
Mr.
a legislature.
Chairman, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomasoni, it goes back to how the state law is written. And for many years, since the inception of this law in 1973, it said that MnDOT, or back then it was the Department of Highways, is responsible for enforcing the prevailing wage law on highway projects, and labor and industry is responsible for enforcement
on everything else.
The law is what needs to be changed in order to get the right kind of enforcement.
Well, maybe the legislature has to help a little bit in this area and do what Senator Thomas said, Minsky and some of the other ones, that they have to report. There's got to be a better accountability somehow, some way.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator.
I don't mean to interrupt you. No, this is interesting. I'm skimming through this, but I came upon... I guess on page 77, but it seems to me that we're really lacking information, and you were lacking hard information or data to come to, conclusions that are going to tell us what direction we should go, although we know we have to do a better job of getting information. So I think that's pretty clear, and that's what you're telling us we need to do. But very interesting, in the middle of that page, based on the 2002 economic census, I'm not sure if that's the demographic, I don't know what the economic census is capitalized. We estimate labor costs to be about 25-27% of total construction costs nationwide. This share has been declining over time. Interesting. I assume the cost of materials up and productivity's up, whatever other assumptions one can read in there. But I just think it's interesting that if the share is not going up overall nationwide, I would have thought it might have been. So.
Yeah, what are the recommendations, of course, is
the contracting agency's authority to monitor and enforce compliance. So it's pretty clear what are the things you're recommending to this group, to the Senate. Why don't we hear from Rosalyn Wade, the Director of Apprenticeship and Labor Standards from the Department of Labor and Industry. Would you come up and identify yourself and give us the department's response?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Rosalyn Wade. I'm the director of the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Unit. I'd like to start my comments by acknowledging the hard work that went into this review by the Legislative Auditor's Office. This is the first time, to my knowledge, that such a detailed, comprehensive study of the actual program has taken place. As the Legislative Auditor's Office indicate, this subject has been studied from time to time, and quite often, as the auditor concluded, you cannot determine what the real impact is, even in looking at those studies. Those studies seem to support the position of those individuals that commissioned those studies. That said, I think that this was indeed the best review that the program has received, have seen for quite some time. I believe it was back in 1991 or 92 that the MAD looked at the prevailing wage program, the Management Analysis Division of the Department of Administration looked at the prevailing wage program, and they came up with some good suggestions at that time. I'll try to stick to my own script here, but I think the comments are very worthwhile. This is an extremely controversial subject. There are strong supporters, there are strong advocates, and the department has taken the position consistent with its own mission to be a neutral administrator of the laws that we are charged with. Regarding the actual report, the agency overall agrees with the findings of the legislative auditors. We believe that the current process is merely a reflection of past practice, current policy, and the available resources that are dedicated to the program area. The overall findings, I think, are very relative. And going back directly to the major findings, I've been associated with this, with the prevailing wage program since 1987. So I've seen a lot of state history. I've looked at the work and the discussion around this issue on a national level, and inherently, because of the sheer nature and the philosophy around prevailing wage, there will continue to be strong supporters and strong opponents. That said, I agree with the legislative auditors that there certainly is room for improvement, but I think if you read the details of the report, you will come away with the sense that it's been a struggling program. It's one of the only programs in the Department of Labor and Industry that receives a general fund appropriation, and it has it weathers the same storm as any other general program area. When there are budget constraints, less resources are dedicated. We've seen that decline for quite some time. Early on, when I came into the agency, actually the prevailing wage program was a standalone program. It had its own leadership. It had its own resources in its entirety. It was a recognized unit within the agency. Over time, over time, that unit was simply merged into the Labor Standards Unit. As many of you are, you may or may not know, but the prevailing wage provisions are included in Chapter 177. That is the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act, which governs both minimum wage and overtime. Prevailing wage is a minimum wage law. However, the same authority that's granted in other portions of the chapter is not extended to the prevailing wage portion of that chapter. So there is misunderstanding, there's general confusion, and then there's just a sheer difference of opinion as to the full responsibilities of the agency. Yes, there is a statement within the prevailing wage law that states, except for highway heavy, the Department of Labor and Industry shall enforce this provision. That provision, it's not laid out in such a way that it is clear to the common reader or clear to the policymakers that the enforcement authority goes to the full legislation. And so over the years, that very provision has been debated as to whether or not Labor and Industry Enforcement Authority is to ensure compliance with the overall prevailing wage law, or whether or not our authority is limited to investigating complaints. We do have a complaint process, as the legislative auditors indicated, because we have no real resources, we have no real leverage in terms of negotiating with contractors. We are extremely successful in some arenas, but because of the controversy surrounding this topic, in many instances, we are not as effective as we are in enforcing the remainder of the Fair Labor Standards chapter. We believe that much of the debate around this subject we can make more headway by educating the different communities. I participated in a townhouse meeting back on September 5th, where we had an outstate contractor who generally opposed prevailing wage law. He gave me a call a couple of years ago, and he was just fired up. I can't believe this wage rate is not correct. Where'd you get this? I want to see your records. And I said, sure. These are public documents. You're very welcome to see it. He looked at the documentation that the agency had received, and Mr. Noble's comments are very meaningful in terms of, we don't have a dictionary. We don't have a prepared script. On an annual basis, my office survey county engineers to identify what contractors have participated in construction projects in the previous year. We take that information, ensure that we are contacting all of the known participants in the construction industry. We survey everyone that we can. It is from that information that new wage rates will be produced. We don't have a package at any given time. We have no predetermination. As I indicated, our role is to be a neutral administrator. But we can only act on the information that we receive. That said, taking it back to the contractor's comments in Ottertail County, he gave really moving testimony about what it was like for him to go from strongly opposing prevailing wage to being a willing participant in the survey process. 1 year he participated, and it didn't make a difference. His wage rates did not prevail. And he called me back, and he's like, you told me if I would, it wouldn't. I said, no, I told you. If you want to impact the prevailing wage rates, you have to participate in the survey. He took that information, and he went back to his own local business community. And he said, hey, guys, these rates, if we don't participate, labor and industry is going to go to adjacent counties. Adjacent counties might be a reflection of a previous adjacent county. Therefore, if we want prevailing wage to be a reflection of the wage rates paid in this area, then we all need to participate. Well, guess what? He went through that, and his wage rates prevailed. And so I believe a lot of the concern, a lot of the confusion over prevailing wage really goes back to, if you're participating on publicly funded projects, you need to be participating in the survey process. However, if philosophically you oppose the law as a whole or whatever it means to you, and that's the deterrent to not participate in setting the rate, then it makes labor and industry, it makes the law, makes everything around it an easy target to say that it's not working. It doesn't have the impact that it's intended to have. With it, the agency role is not to live out the philosophy of it. It's simply to administer the law. On an annual basis, we survey. Once we survey, we analyze the data. We analyze that data, we certify the wage rates. If there is not enough information coming in from a particular county, there are provisions set in place in anticipation that we may not get enough information that allows the agency to look at other information, specifically adjacent counties, our previously certified wage rates, to ensure that all state-funded projects receive the labor that's put forth on state-funded projects receive a certified prevailing wage rate. I talked a little about the investigation of complaints. Historically, I agree with the auditors. There have been confusion because we do not have leverage to withhold any retainage, and because county attorneys, to my knowledge, have never agreed to prosecute a prevailing wage complaint. We are left with informal tools to encourage contract owners to enforce their contract. Keeping in mind that the prevailing wage law specifically charges any state agency who is the owner of the contract to ensure compliance with the prevailing wage law. Labor and industry doesn't own any contracts. We don't let any contracts. We don't manage any money. And therefore, we are left with informal tools. We get a complaint from an individual that may be impacted, or an authorized representative of an individual that may be impacted by prevailing wage. Our first response would be to direct that individual to the contract owner, because there's the money, there's the tie.
Ms. Wade?
Yes.
Yeah. You're giving us a lot of specifics out there, and there's some good examples you're using, but it just seems to me that globally the picture is a little bigger than you're kind of describing it. It's it is already law in the books, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gets back to the basics, reporting and enforcement. How do we get there? And you know, we're arguing a little bit about who's right, who's wrong. You might not like the law today, but it is, as far as I know, the law of the state today. Okay, wait, how do we find out what's going on out there? That's what I think we're talking about, aren't we? And how do we get there? We have to talk to Senator Tomasoni and find out if there's some money over there in your budget to...
Well, Mr. Chair, that's what I was going
to
ask her.
Yeah, to enhance the enforcement, whether it be you guys or, like Senator Tomasoni or somebody else said, maybe it's individual the campuses, whatever it might be. And that doesn't mean we need... Sometimes we can work within the budgets we have around here, too. But if we need more enhancement there, we'll look at that. Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wade, did I hear you say, because we got this one slide here, it says MnDOT is responsible for their projects and then Dolly's responsible for everything else. Did I hear you say somewhere in the prevailing wage law that the agency in charge of the project is responsible for enforcing it?
There is a provision, and I apologize, I don't have Chapter 177 right here before me, but there is a provision within the prevailing wage law that creates an obligation for contract owners to comply with prevailing wage provisions. It requires that the wage rates be posted in every contract that's let, and it holds state representatives in terms of agents of the state responsible for compliance.
So does that mean that,
Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair, does that mean that MnSKU is actually responsible for prevailing wage rates on MnSKU projects?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that means MNSCU is responsible for contract compliance. It's part of their contract requirement to ensure that prevailing wage is included and that that contract is complied with.
So what is Department of Labor and Industries' prevailing wage enforcement requirement in a MNSCU contract?
Well, I think that's what we're here today. I mean, it doesn't sound like it's, to me, like it's getting done, and we've got to figure out.
But I want to find out what the Department of Labor
is. Workers, we have to...
I want to find out what their role is.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the agency has taken this position for as long as I've been there, and like I said, I've been in and about that program area since 1987. It has been the role of the labor and industry to investigate complaints. When complaints are received, we do nothing proactive in terms of monitoring. If a complaint is received, it is clear that we have investigatory authority. But once that complaint is investigated, it's determined whether or not prevailing wage law has been complied with. The only recourse that we've exercised is to turn those findings back over to the contract owner, including the MNSCU, Minnesota Zoo, or whomever else.
It seems to me you should be proactive, not just answer to the complaints you get. I mean, you ought to be out there figuring out who's not doing it the right way according to the law instead of just handling individual complaints. I mean, you're supposed to be out there making sure our people get paid, and we might help you try to do that. So,
let me follow up one more. Now, if we gave you, does the department have the manpower to do an adequate job here?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say not.
He was a representative. He's a senator today.
I apologize.
He's moved up the
senator, and that's the second time. I apologize for the
record.
Say
when you go from the
senator.
House to the Senate, you make both bodies better, but go ahead anyway.
Okay, let me get it right.
Senator Tomasoni.
Chair. I'm still saying it. Senator Tomasoni. I would say not. I manage the labor standards unit. Recently, it was combined with the apprenticeship unit. The labor standards unit itself administers and enforces the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act. That includes all of minimum wage, all of overtime, and the prevailing wage law. We also administer child labor and a lot of other workplace regulations. That unit is represented by a half-time director, that would be me, and seven investigators, okay? That is for all work that's performed by that unit, not just prevailing wage. And so when you talk about being proactive in terms of monitoring projects and so forth, I have seven individuals to do everything that is related to Chapter 177, 181, 181A, and 184. So I do not believe that there are adequate resources at this time to effectively enforce the prevailing wage provisions. I would like...
And if they're breaking the laws, you know, I have no problem with the advancing the penalties a little bit. Slap a few people a little harder, and maybe somebody will get the idea out there that they're not supposed to be non-conforming, so to speak, so why not raise the penalty? Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wade, did I hear you right that you're splitting your time between this responsibility and the apprenticeship program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Unit was combined in 2003. I'm the director for both units. In terms of FTEs for program areas, I am represented serving as 0.5 or half FTE dedicated to the leadership of the Labor Standards Unit.
That sounds like another problem we're having with Lieutenant Governor, Commissioner. Checking.
No complaint involved there.
Senator Bonif.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wade, I have several questions. One that came up just listening to your response to Senator Tomasoni. When there's a complaint, then you mentioned that then you go back to the contracting agency and let them know of the complaint. But then is there some follow-up where, in fact, you make sure that the complaint, who it was filed against, makes the change?
Mr. Chair, Senator, when a complaint is received, it's very clear to the complainants and to our staff that our office have investigatory authority. We follow a similar pursuit as we would with any other violation to the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act, including reviewing payroll records. That said, we are able to investigate the complaint in its entirety in terms of who got paid, when and where, and for what type of work. However, that's where we hit the wall because we do not have the leverage to work with the contractor in terms of withholding a retainage, not paying the contract in its entirety. It is at that stage when we turn the findings back over to the contract owner. Keep in mind that the contract owner, being a Minsky or the Minnesota Zoo, they're not in the business of construction. They're in a different kind of business, education or housing animals. And so they are dealing with subcontractors along the way. Our role in investigating and turning those findings back over to them is to ensure that they understand where the problem is and what it takes to fix it.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wade, but do you think, is it your experience they do fix it?
Ms. Wade.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have had, I would say, mixed results or mixed feedback in terms of how satisfied the complainants might be. We have been effective, but because we can really act in a far less formal manner in terms of prevailing wage enforcement than with the remainder of the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Wade, actually that brings me to the second part of my question. You talked about that earlier in your talk where you said that there was the rest of the Fair Labor laws were pretty clear in terms of how you were to follow the letter of the law with the exception of the prevailing wage. So I was curious, which parts are you concerned about? It seemed like you were making a broad reference, but I suspected that there was specific things that you were referring to.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as I said, there are some longstanding practices, policies, and even interpretations regarding the limited scope of labor and industry enforcement authority. This issue has been debated repeatedly, okay? In looking at the construction of Chapter 177, the commissioner duties and responsibilities are not as clearly stated when it comes to point 4.4 and 4.5, which is the prevailing wage portion of that. In the remainder of the Minnesota Fair Labor Standards Act, the remedies are clear. The ability to penalize violators is very clear. The latter part of the chapter does not come with clear commissioner responsibilities, penalties, things of that nature. It is just less than clear.
Thank you, Ms. Wade. Mr. Chair, it looks like there's some work to be done legislatively with regard to this.
That's what I think I've been trying to say a little bit here, maybe not making myself very clear. But, you know, we're not going to hear today we're listening to the report, and I trust Senator Bonnef that we are going to have legislation drafted to deal with some of these issues we've been hearing about today. And I've heard there might even be some on the other side of this thing, too, to maybe even weaken, if you will, what the laws that are already in the book. So instead of hearing more testimony today, we're just going to, I think we've just about done, because we are going to hear bills in this committee going forward. So I think we'll get a lot of discussion as we go forward. I know there will be. Ms. Wade, did you wish to say something?
Mr. Chair, yes, I just like to make it clear. As part of the governor's budget, there is an initiative requesting resources for the prevailing wage area, and I just want to be real clear as to what the intent was in making that request. Because of the scenario I described regarding the individual contractor who had taken it up on himself to do outreach and education within his community, and he saw an impact, I asked for the commissioner's support to come up with a working model where our agency would do outreach and education. That is the purpose of the initiative that will work its way through the budget process. So
it's that an educational thing more than it is an enforcement or giving money to see who's a
the intent.
Bad folks out there.
Correct.
So you're trying to educate instead of, okay, nice. That could be a component of it, but maybe it's bigger than that, in my opinion. All right. Any other discussion? Yeah, so we'll be hearing a lot more in this area, and I would encourage any of my fellow senators here, or representatives, senators, yeah, that are interested in this area, get a hold of some of our staff, Mr. Fuller or whoever, and get some language drafted. Okay. Yeah, Wednesday we meet. We're going to hear a couple of bills. So with that, thank you, folks, the auditor and Ms. Wade for coming, and meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.
That's good.
I think we're better not here.
I don't know.
It's probably interesting. It's really a mess.
I think so.
What a mess.
I think we need to go.
I heard they got a really good
place. Like she has a tough job.
Yeah, yeah.
Hawaii.
I heard Hawaii is like the lead of the prevailing wage law.
We go to Hawaii.
He's not really. A little field trip. I'm going to Duluth on
Anthony, you can just turn the button off.
I got to go to the box.
Switch on the bottom or back.
Good. Good to see you. Yep, no, I know.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
So where do you...
Where do you work? Someone.
Are you at
the Attorney General's office? Is a friend.
Okay. I saw you before.
And I, you know, it kind of
I know her in a different place.
I'll have to check with them. I was. Yeah.
It's yeah. Like, right.
Right. Right. Well, it's a subcontract.
Okay. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Reflecting
the
okay.
Okay. I think that's the thing to find out.
I mean, they're
well, we've been concerned about what, you know, what we have. Yeah. So.
So
how are your children?
For tax purposes. All the employment law extensions.
Oh. I love it. I love it. I hope so. I hope so. I'm probably going to... Well, I went to North Woods last year, and I loved it. Yeah, it's smaller, I mean, in terms of the number of kids. So, and it's really nice facility. I mean, the building isn't as nice as Camp Central building. I mean, Camp Central building was old and in trouble, but I like the outside is so much nicer than even at the CAC. So that's why I didn't want to go there. But yeah.
Yeah, the colony of that email you looked at was where.
Oh, but he, yeah. Well, you know, I was at Northwoods. I mean, I like it. Did you? Yeah, yeah.
Where.
Their enforcement
percentage of their revenue.
Yeah. Grzynewski, I think, yeah.
$1,000.
Okay. Right.
Oh, okay, okay. I've been working on a couple of the non-school day things at Zanewood. That's a whole different.
But it isn't.
I mean, all the kids are eligible to go to it.
Or is that reserved for?
But it's like the younger ones are six and up, so it's not quite like camp. And it's hello. Thank you. That's right.
Strictly fit general.
Glad to know where you are. That's
who's got the guts to.
Oh, it is. And to get hard.
I've been around.
That would be helpful.
Value-added agriculture.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Although I've read an awful lot of this already.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, bye-bye.
Well, I just wanted to use the tax grant.
You say it, but there's no. It seems like everybody's saying it's not.
On the sales tax and construction.
I thought that the.
Creates an incentive.
We haven't looked at it.
Trying to look at it. Okay, no. What can we do? Opponent.
What certifying
the light or
really narrow.
Has there been things done?
That debt service equalization aid law was my law too, and the Supreme Court threw it out.
One is taking responsibility.
Right.
And I thought we were right. That is
we need rules about
go back and look at that works.
Now Ramsey County, within St. Paul, it's a ban. Now, after they did the ban, all these places started doing patios or porches where they have two existing walls.
I went right in the statue.
And then possibly a roof, but it has to be. Now with winter, a lot of them are putting like plastic or plexiglass, and they're ending up getting closed in where
I'll send to that number.
But then Ramsey County, besides St. Paul, the other places are still conforming to that. As long as a certain percentage of your sales are from liquor and smoke. If it's a bar restaurant, like say, chain.
Yeah, also, it's the rules. Way of doing it is
the ability to enclose their bar area with glass, and they can smoke within that area and not in the restaurant portion. So Ramsey County is still under.
St. Paul's
that,
yeah.
But St. Paul. Because
we go after
volleyball,
we go to
old. I'm a small general contractor. My people do a lot of different work. They love them. When we get them, that's fine. We'll go off those and make a great point.
I don't know who you meant.